You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Spiritual Hierarchies and the Physical World. Lecture 7, The Constitution of Spiritual Beings and Humanity, given on April 16th, 1909, in the evening. I would like to begin by making an observation about the end of yesterday's lecture. I noticed that some of you attached a certain amount of importance to the fact that in the blackboard sketch each planet was in line with the sun, so that a kind of common conjunction was depicted. I want to emphasize that this is of absolutely no importance in relation to what we are considering now, though we shall need such concepts later. Nevertheless, it is important that we do not give ourselves over to erroneous ideas. To repeat, first we drew the sun according to the Copernican system, then Mercury, esoteric Venus, then Venus, esoteric Mercury, followed by the Earth with its moon, then the orbits of Mars, Jupiter, and finally Saturn. This represents the Copernican cosmic system. Having done this, as I said yesterday, I would now like to place before you the system taught in a school of Zoroaster. You must not think, however, that Zoroaster personally taught it. I am rather talking of elementary truths that were current in the schools of Zoroaster. The constellation of the twins, Gemini, is thus at the top. Then we take those points on the line from Gemini to the sun, and irrespective of whether there is such a conjunction or not, we connect the sun with the constellation of the twins. The positions of Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars do not matter. The purpose of the sketch is merely to show the orbits. They mark out the boundary of the various hierarchies. Now, to designate the realm of Saturn, we have to imagine the Earth, not the Sun, at the center. To do so, we must draw a circle with the Earth at the center. Actually, it is not really circular, but egg-shaped. We proceed in a similar manner for the other heavenly bodies. Please discount aspects of secondary importance in this drawing and concentrate on what really matters. The aim here is to illustrate the corresponding figures for the realms of influence of the respective hierarchies. Today we shall consider in greater detail the nature of the members of the higher hierarchies immediately above humanity. The easiest way is to start with the human being, for only by becoming absolutely clear about what has repeatedly been said about the nature of the human being and human development can we rise to an understanding of the nature of the members of the higher hierarchies. We know that human beings, inasmuch as they dwell and have developed on Earth, consist essentially of four constituent parts. These are the physical, etheric, and astral bodies, and the I, capital. Let us depict these four members in a diagram. Let us represent the physical body with a larger circle, the etheric and astral bodies with smaller circles, and finally the I with the smallest circle. You know how human development proceeds. In the course of earthly development, the human being begins to work on the astral body through the I. In general, we can say that to the extent that a human being works upon the astral body with the I, so that this molded part of the astral body has come under the authority of the I, it is called manas, or spirit self. Thus the manas, or spirit self, as has often been emphasized, is not to be regarded as something newly added to the human being. Rather, it is simply the transformed product of the astral body. What I am describing here applies only to the human being. It is important that we don't simply extend generalizations without thinking, but realize that beings in the universe are very different from one another. Therefore, let us now draw the fifth member, the transformed astral body, or manas, as a special circle. It should really be drawn inside the astral body. Above it, we draw the transformed etheric body, because, in so far as the etheric body has been transformed, we characterize it as buddhi, or life spirit. When the etheric body has been completely transformed, it is entirely buddhi. Similarly, if we consider the human being in its ultimate perfection, a stage that can be attained by evolution through Jupiter, Venus, and Vulcan, the physical body is transformed into Atman. Thus, when human beings in the Vulcan stage have reached the highest goal of perfection, they can be represented diagrammatically as follows: Atman, Buddhi, Manas, I, astral, etheric, and physical bodies. What is most characteristic in this scheme is the fact that the seven members form a whole, that these seven principles interpenetrate one another. That is the most important aspect. But this is not the situation when we turn to the members of the next hierarchy, the angels. We can apply this diagram to the human being, but not to any angelic beings. Angels have developed a physical body, an etheric body, and an astral body in such a way that these in certain ways form a totality. But we must draw the I, Manas, Buddhi, and Atman of the angels as separate from the rest of their being. If you want to clarify an angel's nature, you must imagine the higher members, which the angels have and can develop, hovering in the spiritual world above that part existing physically. Actually, the angel has, however, only formed completely the Manas member, Buddhi, and Atman will be developed later. Actually, the angel has, however, only formed completely the Manas member. Buddhi and Atman will be developed later. An angel, unlike a human being, does not have an accompanying I within an earthly body, nor does an angel develop Manas in the present stage of earthly development. That is why one would hardly think that the part of an angel present in the physical world belongs to a spiritual being. When one meets human beings, it is obvious that they carry their members within them. Everything is differentiated organically. But if you want to find an angel, you must remember that an angel's physical aspect, here, below, is a reflection of the spiritual principles visible only in the supersensible world. You will find the physical bodies of angels in flowing water, in mist rising from evaporating bodies of water, and in the wind and lightning flashing through the air, as well as other occurrences of this kind. One of the first stumbling blocks for the human being is the firm conviction that a physical body must have a definite boundary. As human beings, we find it difficult to say to ourselves, "I stand in a rising or falling mist, or before a spraying brook. I am surrounded by the rushing, roaring wind. I see lightning flashing in the clouds." These are the revelations of the angels. I need to see that beyond this physical manifestation, which is not as narrowly defined as the human one, is a manifestation of a spiritual body. As human beings, we develop all of the members of our being as self-enclosed entities. That is why we cannot imagine that a physical body can appear hazy and indistinct, that it may float and hover in the air, that it need not have definitely outlined contours. You must imagine, for example, that 80 angels may have the densest part of their physical nature in one stretch of water. We should not imagine that the physical body of an angel needs to be limited in any way. An angel can belong to a portion of water here, far away is another segment. In short, we see that everything that surrounds us as water, air, and fire on earth must be so conceived as to contain the bodies of beings belonging to the hierarchy immediately above humanity. To behold the eye and Manas of angelic beings, however, we need clairvoyant sight in the astral world. Angelic beings look down upon us from higher worlds. To find them, we must investigate the realm of the solar system that extends as far as the orbit of the moon. matters are relatively simple with regard to angels. If, for example, we have the physical body of an angel down here in a sheet of water or something similar, and if we investigate this portion of water or gust of wind clairvoyantly, we discover within it an etheric body and an astral body. That is why we have drawn these three members, so that they are connected with one another. Of course, what we find in rushing wind, in flowing or evaporating waters, is not just the material image seen by common perception. The etheric and astral bodies of angelic beings dwell in everything belonging to water, air, and fire, in the most varied ways. But if you wish to find the soul spiritual nature of these angels' beings, of these angels' being, you must investigate the astral realm clairvoyantly. If we wish to consider the archangels in the same way, the process is again different. Their astral body, as we have drawn it here, is not connected in any way with the physical and etheric bodies. We must draw their lowest member as the physical and etheric bodies. These are separate from the principles that dwell above in higher worlds. To get a complete picture of the archangels, we must look in two places. Their being is not like that of a human, where everything is united into one being. An archangel has a spiritual part above and a reflection of the spiritual down below. A physical body and an etheric body can be united only if the physical body consists of air and fire. For example, you could not sense an archangel's physical body in rushing, roaring water. You could only perceive it in wind and fire. And you would have to look for the archangel's spiritual counterpart, which is manifest in the rushing wind and fire, clairvoyantly in the spiritual world. That part is not even united with the physical etheric body. We now come to the beings we designate as archai, or primal beginnings, primal powers, or spirits of personality. Here, below, we can draw only the physical body. All the rest is above, in the spiritual world. Such a physical body can live only in fire. The physical bodies of the archai can be perceived only in flames of fire. When we see the flashing fire of lightning, we can say that there we have something of the body of the archai, but above, in the spiritual world, we can find clairvoyantly the spiritual counterpart, that in this case is separate from the physical body. Indeed, the clairvoyant faculty can investigate the archai with comparative ease. These spirits of personality dwell in a realm extending to the astronomical Mercury, esoteric Venus. Let us assume that someone has developed the capacity to observe what develops up there in the sphere of Mercury. Such a person could then behold the highly developed beings known as spirits of personality, the archai. Suppose this person gazes clairvoyantly up to Venus to observe the gathering of the spirits of personality, and then turns to the lightning flashing through the clouds. The person would see in the lightning the reflection of the spirits of personality, because the lightning contains their physical bodies. Next we reach the more exalted spiritual beings, who extend their influence to the orbit of the sun. These powers, or exousiae, will concern us less today. It should only be pointed out that the archai act through the instrument of Venus and Mercury beings, that is, through Venus beings who have their physical bodies in fire, and Mercury beings who have their physical bodies in fire and wind. You must imagine that is the lower organs of their influence. The beings who dwell in the sun make use of Venus spirits in flaming fire and of Mercury spirits in roaring wind. Quote, "And God makes the flames of fire into his servants and the winds into his messengers." Unquote. Footnote Psalm 104, verse 4. End of footnote. Sayings like this one in the Bible can be found in ancient religious documents. They are taken from spiritual facts and correspond to what can be observed with clairvoyant perception. We have thus seen that the three hierarchies immediately above us are closely connected with our own existence. human beings are the beings they are because in some measure they partake of the solidity of the earth. This separates us from all other beings. It makes a human being into a self-contained entity composed of separate members. On the moon, a human being will still, on old moon, a human being was still a being like others. There, the human being went through transformations that were very much like water masses in a constant state of flux. It was on the earth that, for the first time, so to speak, human beings were caught in their skins. They became self-contained beings consisting of a physical, etheric, and an astral body, and an eye. This occurred only comparatively recently. If we go back to Atlantean time, we find in the first epoch of that time human beings who did not experience their eye fully within themselves. They were still waiting to receive their eye into themselves. If we were to go back still further in earthly development, we find human beings who, we may say, consisted initially only of physical, etheric, and astral bodies. If we go back to Lemurian times, we find that a human being has no more of a physical, etheric, and astral body on earth than the angels have. From this point on, with the growth of the eye from the Lemurian through the Atlantean epoch, the union of the different members begins. In Lemurian times, there were human beings on earth who consisted of only physical, etheric, and astral bodies. These were not human beings in the present sense of the word, beings who could think and develop humanly as we understand it today. Then something remarkable happened on our earth. The human beings, who in Lemurian times sojourned on earth and had only physical, etheric, and astral bodies, couldn't help themselves. They could not manage their earthly existence and didn't know what they should do on earth. Heavenly beings, inhabitants of Venus, now came down to those who lived on earth. And, because the inhabitants of Venus had an affinity with the physical body, they could radiate into and inspire the physical body of the first earth dwellers. Thus we have some of Lemurian humanity who went among the masses of human beings in a very remarkable way. They had a physical body different from the others. The physical body of such an exceptionally endowed human being was not ordinary, but was permeated, ensouled by a Venus spirit, a spirit of personality. Consequently, human beings who moved about in ancient Lemurian times, having a Venus spirit within the physical body, had a powerful impact on their entire surroundings. Outwardly, such Lemurians could not be distinguished fundamentally from their contemporaries, but because a spirit of personality was active in their physical bodies, these specially chosen individuals exerted a subtle yet powerful influence in the highest sense on their surroundings. They were objects of reverence, of awe, of obedience, unlike anything anywhere today. All of the migrations undertaken to populate the various regions of the earth were led by beings permeated with the spirits of personality. Speech was unnecessary. There was no speech then, and no signs were necessary. The presence of such a personality was sufficient. If it was considered expedient to lead great masses of humanity from one place to another, the masses of humankind followed without reflecting upon it. Reflection was also non-existent then, and developed only later. Thus, in ancient Lemurian times, the spirits of personality came down to earth as Venus spirits. These Venus messengers, who had taken on human countenances on earth, such countenances possible then, were of special significance for the whole structure of the universe. Cosmically, they reached as far as Venus, and their activities were of significance for the entire interrelatedness of the cosmic system. They could lead humanity from one place to another, because they knew the broader context that can be understood when one is acquainted not just with the earth itself, but also with its cosmic, quote-unquote, neighborhood. Human evolution continued, and it became necessary for archangels, Mercury spirits, to intervene in this development. It was now their turn to ensoul and enliven what could be found below on earth. This occurred mainly during the Atlantean period. Archangels, spiritual beings from Mercury, descended, beings who could ensoul and spiritualize the physical and etheric bodies of certain human beings. So, we also find human beings among the Atlanteans, who could not really be distinguished outwardly from others, but who were in their physical and etheric bodies ensouled by an archangel. Now, if you recall that yesterday it was said that archangels have the task of directing whole peoples, you will understand that individuals who carried an archangelic being within them could give to the whole Atlantean race of people the appropriate laws as inscribed in the heavenly world. When it was necessary to act more generally, the great leaders of ancient Lemurian times were ensouled by Venus spirits, those whose task it was, in Atlantean times, to direct smaller segments of humanity, the various peoples of the earth, were ensouled by archangels. The priest kings of Atlantean times were really a Maya. They were not what they appeared to be outwardly. An archangel dwelled in their physical and etheric bodies, and this was the actual acting agent. We can go back into ancient Atlantean times and search for the hidden centers of these leaders of humanity. They worked from hidden places where they investigated the mysteries of the universe. Although the word originated later, we may call what was investigated and ordered from those ancient Atlantean mystery centers oracles. The term oracle is very appropriate for the teaching and governing centers of Atlantean humanity, which the archangels carried within themselves. From these centers, great teachers carried out their work, so that they could draw other human beings to them and could train them to become servants and priests in the oracles. It is important to know that in Atlantean times, human beings existed who were actually archangels, that is, in whose physical and etheric bodies an archangel was embodied. Clairvoyantly, one would have seen the physical body of such a being, and behind him a gigantic figure rising above and losing itself in indefinite regions, the inspiring archangel. Such a personality was a twofold being, as if behind the physical human being, arising out of the indeterminate, there were the archangel who inspired the person. At the end of such a being, the physical body was destroyed, according to Atlantean practice. The physical body which had been inspired by the archangel dissolved, but the etheric body did not dissolve. There is a spiritual economy that requires exceptions to what must generally be represented as spiritual scientific truth. We usually say, and in general it is correct, that when someone dies, the physical body is laid aside, and after a certain time the etheric body is likewise laid aside. Apart from an extract that remains, the etheric body dissolves. This, however, is only generally the case. There is an enormous difference between the etheric body of an initiate of the Atlantean oracles, which was permeated by an archangel, and an ordinary etheric body. Such a valuable etheric body is not lost. It is preserved in the spiritual world. The seven most important etheric bodies of the seven great founders of the oracles were preserved by the mightiest leader of the Atlantean oracles. These etheric bodies had been woven through by archangelic beings who at death had naturally returned to higher worlds. Something was preserved, not in boxes, of course, but according to spiritual laws. The Atlantean initiate of the Sun Oracle is none other than the one, often referred to as Manu, who led the remainder of the Atlantean population over to Asia in order to establish the post-Atlantean cultures there. He took a handful of people with him and led them across to Asia. Through generations he cultivated people, and when the qualified seven had been produced and called to serve, he wove into their etheric bodies the seven etheric bodies that had been permeated by archangels and preserved on ancient Atlantis, the seven sent down by the powerful leader to found the first post-Atlantean culture were the seven holy rishis of ancient Indian culture. They bore within their sheaths the etheric bodies of the great Atlantean leaders, who, in turn, had received them from archangels themselves. Thus past, present, and future worked together. You would have found the seven holy rishis to have been simple people, for their astral bodies and eyes had not reached the development of their etheric bodies. In the etheric body was woven their real capacity. Thus they had certain times when inspiration worked in their etheric bodies. Then they said things that they could not have said out of themselves. What had been inspired through their etheric bodies flowed from their lips. They were simple people, even by their own estimation. However, when they were inspired and their etheric body was active, they revealed the profoundest mysteries of our solar system and the whole universe. Even in post-Atlantean times, human beings had not advanced sufficiently to dispense with ensoulment from above. We have seen that this ensoulment took place in Lemurian times because a spirit of personality permeated the physical body. During the Atlantean period, physical and etheric bodies were ensouled by archangelic beings, while in post-Atlantean times the great leaders of humanity were ensouled by angelic beings who had descended into their physical, etheric, and astral bodies. The mighty leaders of the first post-Atlantean periods had not just human physical, etheric, and astral bodies. Each leader was permeated by an angel. This enabled the leaders to look back into their former incarnations. The ordinary person is not able to do so, because he has not yet developed his manas. He must first become an angel. These leaders, born of ordinary people, embodied in their physical, etheric, and astral bodies an angelic being who ensouled and penetrated them. That was again Maya, for they were something very different from what they appeared to represent on earth. The principal leaders of humanity in ancient times were quite different from what they appeared to be. They were personalities in whom dwelt an angel, who inspired them with what they needed to be the teachers and leaders of humankind. The great founders of religion and religious leaders were persons possessed by angelic beings. Angels spoke through them. Things in the world may be described as existing in a state of absolute regularity. Nevertheless, the stages of development are constantly overlapping. What is described as a process of complete regularity does not actually function with complete regularity. What has been said is mainly valid, namely, in Lemurian times, spirits of personality spoke through human beings, in Atlantean times, archangels, and in post-Atlantean periods, angels. But even in post-Atlantean times, we still find human beings whose physical bodies are permeated by spirits of personality, and although they live in post-Atlantean times, they are in the same position as those beings in Lemurian times through whom spirits of personality spoke. There can be human beings in the post-Atlantean era, therefore, who carry entirely the characteristics of the rest of the population, but who, because humankind also needs such great leaders, still carry within them one of the spirits of personality and are the outward embodiment of such a spirit. Furthermore, in post-Atlantean periods, there were those who bore an archangel, a Mercury spirit, in their physical and etheric bodies. Finally, there was a third category of human beings who were ensouled and inspired by angelic beings in their physical, etheric, and astral bodies. They were, in fact, human beings through whom angels spoke. According to traditions of the East, such personalities among human beings received special names. Thus those who outwardly appeared like human beings of the post-Atlantean period, though they bore a spirit of personality in their nature, were ensouled all the way into the physical body by such a spirit, were known in the teachings of the East as Dhyana Buddhas, a general term for human individuals who are ensouled even into the physical body, by a spirit of personality. Personalities ensouled down to the etheric body by an archangel in post-Atlantean times are known as bodhisattvas. Those individuals whose physical, etheric, and astral bodies are ensouled by an angel are called human Buddhas. Thus we have 3 degrees, the Dhyana Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, and the human Buddhas. That is the true teaching of the Buddhas, relating to the various categories of Buddhahood. We have to consider this in connection with the manner in which the hierarchies manifest themselves. What we encounter is remarkable when we look back at earlier undeveloped humanity. Among these human beings, we find some through whom the mighty hierarchies of the cosmos came to speak to the planets. The spirits of the higher hierarchies at work even before the creation of our Earth gradually emancipated planetary human beings according to the degree of their maturity. Here we gaze into profound depths of wisdom. It is extraordinarily important that we discover how primeval universal wisdom was taught to humanity in ancient times. You will hear about the Buddhas. The East teaches of not just one, but many Buddhas, among whom several degrees of perfection are represented. You should keep in mind that a Buddha sojourned on the earth, but behind the Buddha, so to speak, came a Bodhisattva and even a Dhyana Buddha. It could also occur, in a particular instance, that the Dhyana Buddha and the Bodhisattva did not penetrate deeply enough to ensoul the physical body. The Bodhisattva may only have ensouled the etheric body, so that we can imagine a being who could not penetrate deeply enough to ensoul and inspire the physical body, but only the etheric body. A higher being, such as a Bodhisattva, who was physically invisible, since he appeared only in an etheric body, could inspire the human Buddha in a special way. So we might have a human Buddha inspired by an angelic being who could still receive the inspiration of an archangel into the etheric body. Here we gaze into the profound complexities of the human being, and this is very important. Some individuals of former ages can be understood only when we realize that they represent focal points for a number of beings who work and express themselves through humanity. For indeed, many periods do not possess enough great people who can be inspired by the spirits who have to be active. It is therefore often the case that various beings of the higher hierarchies have only a single person on earth to ensoul. Sometimes, besides the inhabitants of Mercury, we have those of Mercury and Venus combined who speak to us through one person. Such concepts help us understand human evolution. We learn to recognize the true nature of the personalities who, when we meet them in their physical form, merely represent Maya. Tomorrow we shall concern ourselves with the origin of the various physical planets, which until now we have considered only as boundary marks. We shall gain an understanding of them as the dwelling places of spiritual beings. The end of Lecture 7.